Now we have a conversation with David Orr, the poetry critic for the New York Times. He's written a new book about Robert Frost's poem, The Road Not Taken. And in that book, Orr contends that it's a poem everyone loves and almost everyone gets wrong. WTC's Richard Winham is speaking with Orr about Robert Frost, and in this conversation they talk about how the poet, like his poetry, was almost often misunderstood and equally underestimated.
It's as if understanding Frost meant misunderstanding him at the same time. That would seem to be, in some ways, the thesis for your book.
Right. I think that's correct. Obviously, in the case of The Road Not Taken, we have these conflicting interpretations and this repeated misunderstanding about the poem, which I should say, by the way, I'm far from the first person to point out that this poem is routinely misunderstood by large numbers of people. I mean, it's something that happens roughly every 7 or 8 years. The misunderstanding, in a sense, seems to fuel the poem. I mean, it keeps it in the conversation. It's one of these poems we like to argue about. But I think that is also true of Frost, and that's one of the reasons why the poem is so central to Frost's enterprise. I mean, Frost wanted to be understood a little bit by everyone, but understood completely by no one, in a way, except himself. And, of course, he also claimed not to really have a complete understanding of his own actions. So, he is, in a way, the ultimate trickster poet.
So in that sense, the poem is a koan, I guess, right? It's what you read into it is what is there.
More or less. I mean, I think that obviously some readings are more persuasive than others. I mean, I think that the usual interpretation of the poem is kind of a salute to individualism. There's a lot of trouble with that interpretation. I mean, there's a lot of problems. You could maybe still come to that conclusion, but you would have to walk a pretty winding road indeed. But I do think it's right to say that there's a lot of room in this poem for a lot of different ideas about choice, about choosing, and about the nature of the self that does the choosing.
You said the act of choosing changes the person who makes the choice. It's an interesting idea, isn't it? I mean, that's a pretty profound philosophical statement.
It is, and you know, it's one. There's a really fine book about Robert Frost by Robert Sagan, and as he puts it, it's a very pithy expression of this. He says, "Experience alters the traveler." And there's a lot of support for that particular idea, which, and I agree with you, it's a really interesting philosophical concept. There's a good bit of support for it in the poem. I mean, at the very beginning, you have the poem starts, "Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry, I could not travel both and be one traveler," where one of the many implicit suggestions there is that if the speaker came back to the same crossroads, which of course would enable him to take both roads, that he nonetheless somehow would not be the same traveler. So as you say, any decision changes you. And of course, that's also supported later in the poem, where Frost writes, "Yet knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back." So one suggestion there is that, you know, obviously there's the suggestion that he may just not come back to the same physical spot, but there is beneath that the suggestion that even if he did come back to the same physical spot, it would be as a different I, a different person in some sense.
Mm-hmm.
He's the great poet of understatement in the English language. I mean, there's no other poet who is as content to say something that looks just almost banal, you know, like sort of tedious sometimes, and yet the more you look at it, the less it seems so, the more interesting it becomes, the more fascinating it becomes. The Road Not Taken is a great example of this. You know, the Irish poet Paul Muldoon says this poem just flies off the page, but the more you look at it, the more complex it seems. And I think the idea that it just flies off the page is really on the mark. I mean, you know, you read this and the stanzas just unfold and it all seems quite simple. And, you know, there's a guy and he's traveling. And then, of course, the more you look at it, the more it becomes this very strange drama of choice and this very odd portrayal of different ways of thinking about choosing and about being in the world. And, you know, the first time you look at it, none of this is evident. And that's just true of so much of Frost's writing. What is interesting to me is that, as you mentioned earlier, you know, he was very upfront about this. I mean, he says to people, you know, I should like to seem to the casual observer altogether obvious. Mm. I mean, you can't be any more straightforward than that. And yet people still keep treating him as if he's obvious. it's incredible. It's like he says to people, you know, what I'm going to do is I'm going to wear a costume of a bear. Of course, it doesn't mean I really am a bear. And he goes around in his bear costume and people are just shouting, look, a bear. I mean, it's really remarkable.
Well, poetry is a bit of a challenge for most people to begin with. So I think maybe that there's some measure of relief there that, you know, that you can actually read this man who's a quote unquote a poet and you can understand what he's saying.
Absolutely.
You know, so that I guess. But the comment you made that for most of his life he was an adroit, if unsubtle, behind-the-scenes manager of his own career seems to be somewhat paradoxical, because he presents himself as, you know, that quintessential plain-spoken New Englander.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's nothing of the poet about him. You know, one of the things that bothers me a little bit about poetry read aloud is that people seem to think they have to read poetry as if it's poetry. You know,
I could not agree with you more.
The cadence
terrible.
And that sort of thing, you know. But he doesn't do that, does he?
No.
As much as his work is conversational, his presentation of it is equally just offhand.
Right, I know. And it's interesting because it's a very deliberate performance that he worked on quite hard.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of effort goes into the presentation of all that ease. Really just a remarkable performer. And you mentioned the line from the book when I was talking about, literary politics and his own management of his own career. You know, I do want to slightly qualify that just because I don't think Frost was, I mean, look, it's hard to be a poet. The world is inclined to ignore you. So you have to do some things to get a little bit of attention. And I don't think that the things that Frost did were particularly unusual for a poet. I mean, I can think of a lot of poets who are vastly worse behaved, including some living poets. But, you know, I do think that, as you say, the managing of the career behind the scenes, you know, writing to the right people and trying to get a review from so-and-so is very much at odds with the Robert Frost you would see if you went to a Robert Frost reading. You know, just the simple workman in his stompy shoes, you know, just saying his poems. And, you know, as I mentioned in the book, that was his way of describing reading his poetry. He was going to say a few poems.
And as a poetry critic, did that make it stand out for you? Do you find, I'm sorry, I'm putting words in your mouth, but do you find some poetry perhaps overwritten or too self-conscious, and that he was somehow able to get around that?
I do, actually. I do find a lot of poetry to be both overwritten and too self-conscious, and they're pretty closely wedded concepts. I think that, and I don't want to seem as if I'm picking on other poets for that either, because, you know, you could take poetry that is pretty forthright about its own difficulty, and it can still be really wonderful poetry. But I think that very, very few writers are as willing as Frost is to be seen for less than they are. And again, I just find that confidence very attractive. I think that a lot of his peers, who are, don't get me wrong, wonderful poets, would have been desperately offended if you thought that they were anything less than world-beating geniuses. I mean, I don't think Eliot would have been very happy if people thought he was a bumpkin. And the fact that Frost didn't even care, I just find something really interesting in that.
Yeah, I don't know. I keep wanting to compare him to Emily Dickinson. There's something about him, as with her, that makes people feel... well, with her, I always had the impression, especially from one of my professors, that he wanted to take her under his wing, that she was a little vulnerable. Robert Frost, on the other hand, you know, that horrible idea that, you know, we vote for the president as a person with whom we'd like to go out and have a beer. You know, Robert Frost sort of comes across that way, doesn't he? You could sit across the table from him and you know, and bend an elbow and just chat. You know,
sure,
and he
sure.
makes you feel very comfortable with him. And at the same time, you know, which I thought was really interesting, the thrust of your book is about choice. And when he had to make a choice, when he basically, from the impression I have from your book, is that he'd sort of hit a roadblock, and he had to do something. And so he says to his wife, "Let's flip a coin. We'll either go to Canada or we'll go to the UK."
Right, and he goes to the UK, and the rest is history. Right, right.
I mean,
again, the
point,
remarkable confidence.
Yeah, and I mean, what was he like, 35 at that point? I mean, he wasn't
a
young
older
man.
Than that. Right. Yeah. I mean, just remarkable confidence. I think he was 38 when he did that. I mean, it's really incredible. I also wanted to say, I thought your comparison to Emily Dickinson is really, really apt. I mean, you know, Dickinson is another figure very easy to underestimate. Her reputation languished for many years. I mean, partly that was because of really bad editing. But she is somewhat like Robert Frost in some ways. I could carefully qualify that because they're also very, very different. Yeah. But, you know, he had deep admiration for Emily Dickinson. I mean, he thought Emily Dickinson was a wonderful poet. So I think it's a very good comparison, actually.
Yeah, I guess what it is that they both chose fairly everyday subject matter, didn't they? But they also, you know, they had what we value in poets, which is that insight to...
That's right. And she even, you know, writes in this sort of sing-songy quatrain that she always writes in. And, of course, she's the master of that verse form. I mean, the absolute master. Just as Frost is sort of the master of the American pentameter line. I mean... They're both technically immensely skilled, but they don't really care if you notice, in a way.
The other thing that keeps coming to mind is the at least for a time anyway, the friction between John Lennon and Paul McCartney. Paul McCartney took enormous umbrage that for so long people kept saying, "Well, Lennon's obviously the better writer," and he's like, "Oh, really? Right. You think? You know?" And in some ways, you know, as much as I admire and delight in his work, John was a slightly more self-conscious poet a lot of the time than McCartney, who, you know, again, took pretty everyday things and put them into songs that are almost transparent.
You know, there are the poets of the, you know, the heavens and the hells, and then there's the poets of the everyday. And it's what's so interesting about Frost is that he is a poet of the everyday, but heaven and hell are both deeply invested in his everyday. I mean, he has a sometimes terrifying everyday.
The book is titled The Road Not Taken and subtitled Finding America in the poem Everyone Loves and Almost Everyone Gets Wrong. If you'd like to hear and see Robert Frost saying his poem, there are several videos on YouTube. There's also audio of him reading many of his poems on the Harper Audio website. For WUTC's Around and About, I'm Richard Winham.